Deuteronomy chapter 8, we'll be studying from this morning. Good to have you. Good to be with us. Glad we can come to this portion of our assembly together where we open God's Word. Appreciate the work that Boyd has done this morning in helping arrange our assembly of worship together. It's good to see Linda Beaver with us this morning after her ordeal with hip replacement. Glad that she can be out with us today. Glad that she's recuperating enough to be back in our presence. We missed you. Lord Oliver Cromwell, Lord Protectorate of England, Scotland, and Ireland, while having his portrait painted, said to the artist, "Paint me pimples, warts, and all. I'll not pay for a farthing more." I'm not sure that really is how many of us would ask for our portrait to be painted. Many of us are very thankful for a program called Photoshop. It does take care of a lot of blemishes that might otherwise be present. In Deuteronomy, Moses is painting a portrait of Israel, warts, pimples, and all. This is his last word to Israel. Chapters 31 and 32 soar with a great deal of passion and emotion that he has toward these people that he has so intimately been connected with for all the years that he led them. But as we come back early to the book in Deuteronomy chapter 8, we then begin to see something that recurs throughout the book in verse 2. "And you shall remember the Lord your God that led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not." Moses says, "You shall remember what the Lord has done, what the Lord has done for you." We've been talking on Sunday mornings for a few weeks, remembering what God has done. I want to look at this story this morning in conjunction with, in harmony with, that theme that we've been developing. Moses is about to turn the reins over to Joshua. Moses longs to lead the children of God into the promised land, but because of one mistake toward the end of his sojourn with them, he's been forbidden by God to be able to do that. He's allowed by God, however, to be able to view the horizon, the landscape of the promised land before God takes care of Moses' life and buries him on top of Mount Nebo. Moses, as he utters these words, realizes that these will be the last words that he will have of Israel, but having them with Israel, he then wants us to see something that is very valuable for us to remember as well. There are four primary points that we're going to have this morning, and then I'm going to have one at the last that is kind of a takeaway for us from this lesson. The very first thing I'd like for us to think about this morning as we look at this text is to look back at chapter 5 and verse 14. Chapter 5 and verse 14. The first thing that he encourages them to remember is to remember their bondage. In chapter 5 and verse 14 he says, back up to verse 12. "Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, nor your daughters, nor your male servants, nor your female servants, nor your ox, nor your donkeys, nor any of your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you." He says, first of all, "I want you to remember your bondage," and he does that by giving them a day called the Sabbath day, a day called the Sabbath to be a day of rest. That idea of rest really was to be a connection of their relationship with them to God, as opposed to just a day of doing nothing, because it really was not a day of doing nothing. It was to be a remembrance of what they had and what they left when they exited, when they had their exodus from Egypt. It was to be a day in which they remembered the bondage they were in for 430 years in Egypt. It was to be a day in which they remembered the labor and the toil, the bondage that was that was impressed upon them by a ruthless ruler who remembered not God by the name of Pharaoh. I want you to remember, sadly, Israel was not many days out until they began to moan and groan and complain about the fact God has brought us out here to die. Oh, they long for the onions, for the garlic. They long for Egypt again. I really doubt that that was really what they wanted. I really doubt that they wanted to go back to the laborious work in Egypt. I really doubt they wanted to go back to eating watered down soup flavored with onions and garlic. But yet, in their spirit, in their heart at this time, all they're thinking about now is, look at what we have now. We've been brought out to this desert, and now we've been brought out to die. God is going to provide for them, but he says, I want you to remember, and he gives them the Sabbath by which to remember. I think there's something for us in that as well. We need to also remember our bondage. We need to remember what we have been set free from. We need to remember the bondage in which we had enslaved ourselves in sin. We need to remember that we were captives to Satan and in bondage to him, having sold ourselves as slaves to sin. We could not set ourselves free. We must not become so fretful and so removed from the cross that what we begin to do is we begin to think, oh, those days, oh, those good old days. And the good old days are the good old days that had to do with being in bondage to sin. And the nostalgic look back was, look at the things I could do. Look at the freedom I did have, which really was license, not freedom. Look at those things that I had before. And now look at the restrictions. Look at the narrowness of my life now. Look at how what I'm prohibited from doing now. I can't enjoy life because. Really? Really? Do we not remember what it was like when we first realized that we were lost? Do we not really remember the pain and the agony of our heart when we realized that we were doomed for a devil's hell? Do we really want to go back to that kind of bondage? Do we really want to go back to the kind of life in which we had ourselves enslaved, but yet saw ourselves as free? Certainly we don't want to do that. Paul always stayed close to that. He will say over and over again, I was the chiefest of sinners. I persecuted others more than any others. I am as one born out of due season. I don't fit with the rest. Paul never forgot. He never forgot where he came from. And yet Paul never longed for going back to that again. In fact, when Paul will review his life, he'll review his life not with a great deal of glee, not with a great deal of nostalgia, but to tell what he had left behind and the joy of having left it behind. He said, I was a Hebrew of Hebrews. I was of the stock of Benjamin. I was a Pharisee and nobody excelled me in doing that. Yet, he said, all these things I counted for lost, that I might know him and the power of his resurrection and his suffering. He said, the things that are left behind aren't as great as the things that have been provided for me now. I simply want to know him. Paul had it all as far as a Hebrew and a Jew and a Pharisee was concerned. But he said, those things were nothing to me. Concerning the law, he said, I was blameless. And yet he was brought face to face with his own blame. And being brought face to face with that blame, realized the captivity was not as great as the freedom. Israel needed to remember their bondage. They needed to remember from where they had been set free. Second of all, we need to go back to Deuteronomy chapter 8 and look at verses 1 through 2. We need to remember the commandments of the Lord. Verse 1 of chapter 8. Every commandment which I command you today must be careful to observe that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember the Lord your God led you all these way, these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble you and to test you and to know what's in your heart and what you should keep his commandments. The Lord said, this is a period of testing that you're going to go through. You're going to keep these commandments. They needed to remember the commandments of the Lord. Jesus will say it this way, it is written when tempted. When tempted, Jesus referred to the commandments of the Lord. He referred to what God had said. What God had said was as much life for him as the manna that would be supplied to Israel. And what he says to them is, you need to remember the commandments of God. We don't have to get so far removed from the time that the Bible was revealed that we forget the commandments of God. We need to always have those commandments of God in the forefront of our mind. As the Jew would wear them on a phylactery, on the forefront of their forehead, to have them written on our forehead, to always have them ever present before us. They needed to remember the commandments of God. Israel needed to remember because Israel was going to forget. Solomon will say in Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 1, to remember the commandment that God has given and the law that is put onto your heart. Oh, my son, remember those things. And Jeremiah will say, my people have forgotten the commandments of the Lord. There's something serious about that. Look down further in Deuteronomy chapter 8 and look at verse 20. As the nations which the Lord destroys before you, so you shall perish, because you would not be obedient to the voice of the Lord. So he says, as a result of this, verse 18, you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who has given you power to get wealth, and gives you power to get wealth that he may establish his covenant which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. Then it shall be, if by any means you forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify to you this day that you shall surely perish. As the nations which the Lord destroys before you, so you shall perish. Could they forget that day? Could they forget the day in which the commandments of the Lord were given to them? Could they forget that day when its presentation by the Lord was so awe-striking it struck them in fear? And they said, let you speak to us, Moses, that no longer God speak to us directly. Because the thundering and the lightning was so overwhelming to them. They were so moved and overwhelmed by the power of God. Could they forget the day that God revealed his commandments to them? But what did God say would happen if they did? He said, you will be destroyed and you will perish like all of the nations. Turn back to the book of Genesis chapter 15. Genesis chapter 15. Look beginning in verse 13. Then he said to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be a stranger in a land that is not theirs and will serve them. They will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve, I will judge. Afterward, they shall come out with great possessions. Now, as for you, you shall go into be you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation, they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. And then he begins to talk about how the Amorites are going to be destroyed by God. The Amorites, the Canaanites, all those that inhabit the land because they worship their idols are going to be destroyed by God. And what did God say? For his chosen people, chosen Israel, whom he has nourished, what does God say that he will do for them if they forget his commandments? That you'll be destroyed like all the other nations are destroyed when their iniquity is full. Israel needed to remember the commandments of the Lord. Going back again to Deuteronomy chapter 8, I want you to see, third, they needed to remember what God had done for them. Look beginning in verse 10 of Deuteronomy chapter 8. When you have eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest, when you have eaten and are full, and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, when your herds and your flocks multiply, your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, And when you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through that great and terrible wilderness in which fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought you water out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. Then you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. They needed to remember what God had done. I suspect that every morning when they woke up and they saw manna on the ground, that it would have been hard for them to have forgotten what God had provided them that day. There was a stark, overt reminder right before them. As they walked out that front door that day, the manna was there. But now, he says, you're going to be brought into land. I'm going to give you this land. And in that land, you're going to have houses you did not build. You're going to have vineyards you did not plant. You're going to have prosperity like you have never imagined before. And he warns them about two things in that. When that prosperity comes, don't you forget God, and don't you forget what God has given you in making you prosperous. And second of all, don't you get so full of yourself in forgetting that, that you lift yourself up with pride in doing so. In the book of James, chapter 4, James chapter 4, verse 13. Listen to the warning of James that is as current for the writing of James and those he wrote to as it is for what Moses spoke. James 4 and verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there, buy and sell and make profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. What's James warning them about? James is warning them about the very thing that Moses warned about when he spoke his last message to the children of Israel. You beware, lest in your prosperity you make your plans, and in your plans you make them without God. That God's not even a part of what your plans are. It's not what we say. It's not that we fail to say, if the Lord will. It's not that we fail to utter those words. It's not the verbal expression he's concerned about, that you just did not say, if the Lord wills, before you did something. That's not what he's concerned about. What he's concerned about is that what we do is we get to looking at our life. And we get to looking at how prosperous we are. We get to looking at how wealthy we are. We get to looking at how comfortable we are. And we begin to give an evaluation of that. And we begin to set our plans for our lives. We begin to chart our path for where our life is going to be. We begin to look at the end point of what we want to achieve from our objective in life. And what we conclude is then, look at what I have done. Look at how I've lifted myself up, the proverbial by my own bootstraps. Look at what I have provided. Look at what I have learned. Look at what I, by the might of my hand, have accomplished. There was another man who had that same problem. Remember his name? Nebuchadnezzar. And you remember what happened to Nebuchadnezzar when he said, look, I have built a house fit for royalty. Look at what I have done by my might and by my power. And the Lord warned him, yes, and you're going to be humbled, because what you're going to do now is you're going to eat the grass from the field just like the cattle. And there was a period of time that Nebuchadnezzar found himself humbled. Wet with the dew every morning like a cow in the pasture, waking up eating the food a cow would eat from the pasture, and then having to learn that God, Jehovah God, is so great. Because Nebuchadnezzar boasted, look at what I have done. Look at what I have built. Look at what I have accomplished. James warns, don't boast in the day. Don't boast in the day because you forget God gave you your prosperity. Don't boast of the day because we have lifted ourselves up and we have lifted our own hearts up. James warns, don't boast in that arrogance. Because what we have, Moses reminds them, is because of what God has given. The fourth thing that we see, we turn to Deuteronomy chapter 9. Deuteronomy chapter 9 and verse 6, we need to remember our failures. Look, beginning in verse 6. Therefore, understand that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness. For you are a stiff-necked people. Remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day you departed from the land of Egypt until you came to this place, you have been rebellious against the Lord. And in Horeb, you provoked the Lord to wrath, so that the Lord was angry enough with you to destroy you. When I went up into the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant, which the Lord made with you, then I stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water. Then the Lord delivered to me two tablets of stone written with the finger of God, and on them were all the words which the Lord had spoken to you on the mountain from the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly. And it came to pass, at the end of 40 days and 40 nights, the Lord gave me two tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. Then the Lord said to me, "Arise, go down quickly from here, for your people whom you brought out of Egypt have acted corruptly. They've quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded, and they have made themselves a molded image. Furthermore, the Lord spoke to me, saying, 'I have seen this people, and indeed they are a stiff-necked people. Let me alone, that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven, and I will make you a nation mightier and greater than they.'" The second thing they were to remember was the commandment of the Lord. "Thou shalt have no other graven images before me." 40 days and 40 nights, Moses was absent from their midst. 40 days and 40 nights. By our calendar, that's a month and 9 days, a month and 10 days, depending on whether 30 days or 31 days in a month. A month and 2 weeks, Moses was out of their presence. And they forgot the commandment of the Lord. And the Lord now reminds them through Moses in his last address to them, "You need to remember your failures." In fact, in the book of Hebrews, as the Hebrew writer writes that letter of exhortation, he writes that letter of exhortation to them, reminding them of what their fathers had done, and warns them lest there enters into them an evil heart of unbelief as well. Furthermore, these to whom Moses is speaking are not the fathers that turned away. He's reminded them of what their fathers had done. And he's reminded them of the failures of their fathers, lest they commit the same failures of their fathers. Someone has said, if we don't learn from the past, we're doomed to repeat the same mistakes. Well, there's no originality with failure, is there? There's no new original way to fail, is there? I mean, man hasn't invented in 2016, with all of our technological digital genius, a new way to fail. We may have enhanced it a little bit by some of our technology, but we haven't invented a new way to fail, have we? It all boils down to what? We don't remember the commandments of God, or we lift ourselves up against God. Doesn't it really boil down to that? And then what we do is we set about to make our own way before God. Because why? Because God's not with us. Paul will use this incident as a lesson to the Corinthians. Look over in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And look at verse 11. Actually, you begin back at the first part of the chapter, and he takes a running start at this, as Paul will do. For example, he comes in verse 3, "All ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, that was Christ." And so he talks about how God provided for them in the wilderness. They went, their clothes never wore out, they were never thirsty, God always provided food for them. And then he says, verse 7, "Do not become idolaters, as the people sat down to eat and drink." And then he begins to list the sins. Then he comes down to verse 11 and says, "Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come." He tells his Corinthians, living in the citadel of cesspool, citadel of immorality in Corinth. He tells these Corinthians, these Corinthian Christians, these new Corinthian Christians, don't repeat the mistakes of the past. The failure of your fathers is given to you as an example. Is given to you as an example, and I admonish you not to repeat those failures. If we tie this point back into the first point for just a moment, remembering our bondage and remembering our failures, if we remember where we failed, then we'll remember why we are in bondage. But remembering our failures helps us also identify where our weaknesses are and where the landmines in our life are. It helps us use wisdom to navigate ourselves through, to use stable judgment, knowing where we put our foot carefully in order how to walk through life. Why? Because we pay attention to our failures. We notice where we have failed and we have grown from those failures. And they're there for us as an example, but not only an example for us. They are an example for our children as well. That as our children look at our lives, look at the life of their father, and they see the failure in the life of their father, they say, that's an example to me. I'm not going to make that failure. I'm not going to make mistake. I have seen where that mistake leads. I'm not going to do that. Now, I don't know how objective children think about that at home. And I don't know at what point at home they begin to think about that. But I know there's a point in time in which we reflect upon the life of our parents and we begin to look at their life and we say, well, I'm not going to be like that when I get to be their age. Well, maybe you will, maybe you won't. Have you ever been their age? I've never been 86. I've never been 89. I don't know what it's going to be like when I'm 86 and 89. You might want to pray for Cody and Cam. However, it's a little presumptuous of me to say, I'm not going to be like that when I'm 86 or 89. I can see where my father and my mother are, and as perfect as I think they are, I see they still have a few warts and pimples that they might not want in their family portrait. But I'm doomed to say, I'm not going to commit those mistakes. I'm not going to be like my mother. I'm not going to be like my father. Yes, young people, learn from the mistakes of your parents. The parents, we need to learn from our own mistakes and not repeat the mistakes of our failures as well. It ought to be in our spiritual maturation process, our transformation process, that we realize where we were and now where we are and where we're going to go. That's what transformation is all about. Yes, I've learned from the past. That's not what's holding me down. I'm living in the present, but I'm looking forward to the future, to something that's better than I have it today. And isn't it true? Don't we always say as parents, I always want it better for my children than I had it for myself. I got to tell you, I don't know how I'm going to do that for Cody and Cam. Because I had it so very good as a child in my father's home and under his oversight. But we say that, don't we? And I tell you, I think I see young people. I think I see that in my kids. I think they are spiritually far advanced from what I was at their age. I think they see their spiritual maturity and their guidance and their parenting in that prism. Maybe I was there and I didn't see it because I was there. Because all I see when I look at them is I see the failures that I made in raising them. And I see the successes they're having in raising their kids. And yet, at the same time, it's like, uh-oh, I see Ricky in that mirror. I hear Cody Glenn get on to Kasem. And I'm thinking, man, that sounds just like me getting on to him. And I'm thinking, man, son, back off a little bit. And then I'm thinking, no, there was a reason I did that with him, and there's a reason he's doing it too. Sometimes we see ourselves, don't we? We need to remember our failures along the way too. Because remembering those failures will help us be more successful. When we remember the bondage that we have, we'll appreciate the freedom all the more. Now, I want to bring this home, what I call bring it home. And the last part, I want to talk about us a little bit. And I have to tell you, I'm really not sure how to do this.
But let me just tell you, this is not Ricky, one of the elders, talking. This is Ricky, an evangelist, talking here. I'm representing only Ricky, and Ricky, the byproduct of Ricky's study and the observations of Ricky of working with this congregation. I want us to think about ourselves just a moment here. And I want you to understand. I realize I have a forum to speak, but I'm not really trying to take advantage of anybody in doing that. I just want us to think a minute. I really just want us to think. And I'm really not trying to reach up and slap somebody in the face. I'm really not trying to poke somebody in the eye here. I'm really not. I just want us to think a minute. And I just want us to remember what God has done for us a moment. Of we who comprise this congregation and this assembly today, we're not a part of where this church began in November of 1963. I'm likely to overlook somebody, but as I recall, there may just be four people in this church that are present now that were present then. Ann and Peggy, Leon and Nancy. Some others came fairly immediately after that, but not in the beginning. When this church began, it began in a little house on Randolph Street in Garland, Texas. That house had to have some walls knocked out of it so it would have a place for the small group that started to meet. Approximately 4 years later, there was a structure that was built on Walnut in Garland. In 1971, that structure underwent some renovation. And in 1974, that structure underwent another renovation. What is now the Campbell Road Church then worshipped on Walnut Street until 1984. Now, some of you come into play a little bit more than what 1963 was. Many of you in 1984 remember the building of that structure of what came to be identified geographically as College Park on the corner of Centennial and Bowser in Richardson, Texas. Many of you remember the stories, working late at night, helping get that structure built, ready to assemble in. The group that is now Campbell Road assembled at that structure in Richardson, Texas until September of 2003. The building of this structure took place over a 21-month period of time. Many here gave life and sleepless effort to the construction of this building. I'll never forget. 1 o'clock in the morning. You have the stanchions over here and we're putting tiles in the ceiling. I remember September 2nd. Before we're going to meet here Sunday morning, September 3rd, man, there were a bunch of punch-out items that had to be done, and we were pushing the mercy of the fire marshal of Garland, Texas, to prove our meeting in here September 3rd. There was an army of people that were here. Many of you were part of that. But Sunday morning, September 3rd, was our first assembly in this building. In the 53-year history of this church, the first 17 years of this church, there were no elders. But for the past 36 years, this church has been benefited by shepherds leading this flock. In August of 1991, when Jody and I and the kids moved here, there was currently a renovation going on in the Bible classes because the observation was there that the Bible classes were not adequately doing what the elders were desirous of the Bible classes producing. There were five men that were responsible for looking at that and tearing it apart and putting it back together. And the curriculum that we now use has undergone several emanations, several renovations, until it's being refined. And at that point, we began to produce our own material and teach from our own material our children in our Bible classes. I don't go to the camps the kids go to because I like air conditioning and warm and cold water running together. I camp out well at Holiday Inn. The boys told me that whenever the camps take place, especially the one that is called the Texas camp, that regularly the children who shine the most with regard to Bible responses are the children from this congregation. But folks, we can't always assume it's going to be like that. A couple of amazing things to me is that in view of what I just said about that in the Bible classes and the ardor there was nearly 25 years ago to put together a Bible class work that would then be productive for our young people and our adults, it's amazing to me that Matt and Gerald have to forever and always be beating a bush to find teachers. And they know when you see them coming, you go the other way. Have we forgotten something? Now, folks, we don't have to have Bible classes. We don't have to have Bible classes. We don't have to have a 2-year-old. We don't have to 3-year-old. We don't have to have a high school class. We do not have to have Bible classes. But it ought to be that what we remember is the value of the commandment of the Lord, and as a collective together, there's a profound and deep interest in what we can do to help establish the Word of God in the hearts of our young people and our adults. Wouldn't it be sad as in the days of Hosea it was said they had not the Word of God? Now, Bible classes aren't the primary means of teaching the Bible. That begins with me as a parent. That begins with you as a parent. Bible classes are at best supplementary to that. They're not primary. If I as a parent am not doing that, then have I forgotten something? Do we think that it will always be as it is because we've beaten the bushes to beat the heads of a few to teach the Bible classes? Really, the question I have is, why aren't more beating a drum to stand in line to say, let me, let me, let me? Because look at what we have. Just take a minute. Look at what we have here. Is it always going to be that way? I said for 36 years this church has known an eldership. For the first many, many years, there were just two men. It was Dale Davis and Joe Fagan. And years later, Charlie King was added. And in 2005, myself and Breck were added. In the last 4 to 5 years, James and Terry and Mike and Rick were added. Do we think it's always going to be that way? Do we think we're always going to have elders? I mean, where'd they come from? They just fall off the tree? They come from outer space? Are they aliens that just inhabited human bodies? Is it always going to be that way? Do we take for granted that it's always going to be that way? In our worship assemblies, in the very beginning, and I don't say this with any means to sound denigrating at all, I'm saying it's what it is, because I think he does a fine job. Leon Gray was the only song leader this church had for years. And then Gail and Linda Beaver came. And then others came. I'm old enough now to go back where in Tucumcari, New Mexico, when I was about in the third grade there when Dad moved there, I still remember the old hymnal number 2. And I remember when Sacred Selections came out. And it had, "Have a Little Talk with Jesus," and he bore it all. And it had, "Our God, He is Alive, and Let Me Walk with Thee." Man, you would have thought there was a cry then at that time that, what happened to hymnal number 2? And then we went to Songs of the Church, and then we went to RJ's book. And then churches across the land have moved to supplementals. And then churches have moved to adding songs that are in the supplementals, not peculiar to this congregation. At one time we had one man that was the song leader of this congregation. Now we have over 24. Will it always be that way? And when these men come to lead us in song, they do that to help us praise God in song. Will it always be that way? And isn't it true that every generation introduces and has learned new songs that eventually become old songs for us? Would it always be hymnal number 2? Do we really remember what we have here, folks? The strength of this congregation is its wealth. And I don't mean monetarily. The strength of this congregation is the wealth of her resources. Translated. The strength of this congregation is you. The weakness of this congregation is us. When I go hold meetings, I go to a place where there's 30 people or less, and they would love to have one song leader. But they do the best they can. I'm not denigrating them. I worship God with them there as fervently as I do here. I go to places where the song leading is so slow, you'd think the Lord is going to come back before you finish the song. And I'm not denigrating them, because I can worship with God as fervently with them as I can here. The wealth is also our weakness. And when I'm at those places, I'm thinking, what's taking place at Campbell Road? Folks, we can't like Israel become so filled with our wealth that we forget our bondage. We forget the commandments of the Lord. We forget our failures and we forget what He's provided for us. Every person here is a gift from God. And folks, we're greater together than we're ever going to be alone. But the other side of that is this. The thing that makes us strong will make us weak and can also be our undoing. I wish I was wiser to know how to say this. I realize I'm not wise in that. And I'm just one. And I'm speaking as just one. And it's not about me. It's about what we are able to accomplish together when we assemble like this as we worship God before His throne. And my good friends and brethren, what we have here is absolutely amazing and astonishing. But I'll tell you why it is. It's because of what God has done for us. Can we remember that? And personally, individually, do you remember when you first married, how you started out? Or as a young single person, the first time you were out on your own, do you remember what that was? Eat out? Hamburger Helper would have been a gourmet meal. A house? A new house? Having an apartment would have been a luxury. A car? Just a car that ran. Didn't matter how much it smoked. Just a car that ran would be good enough. And now, if we can't eat out at Ruth's Chris every time we want to, if we can't drive the car we want to, we can't have the new house we want, then we're just not happy. You know the greatness of the United States of America? It's her wealth. And I'm not talking about $18 trillion in debt. I'm talking about the ingeniousness of the people that comprise the United States of America. And our weakness is the people. And are we not seeing that today? I'm not taking a political stance here at all. I don't care what your flavor is about that. But is it really necessary that what we're doing is we're going to tear everything up in sight because we don't get our way out of this person? Then name me a president and a Congress and a Senate and a Supreme Court that has always given everybody what they want. It's never been that way. But I tell you what, I'll take it over the alternative. I'll take it over the alternative of living under Putin. I'll take this over the alternative of living under ISIS. I'll take this over the alternative of living under the Ayatollahs. There's no greater nation than the United States of America. And men shed her blood and God shined His grace on thee. But as individuals, we need to remember. We need to remember the bondage that our forefathers objected to. We need to remember the commandments of God that gives government her purpose and her limits. We need to remember what God has done for this nation. The land is called milk and honey, and we need to remember the failures of this nation and her leaders as well. And I need to remember that I'm only a part of this nation as a citizen because God blessed me to have parents who live here. And I'm blessed to be a child in the kingdom of God to serve the King Himself because He gave His blood. And I am blessed beyond expression of gratitude that there were three men in June of 1981 that called me and said, "Would you like to come talk to us about working with us at College Park?" And I'm grateful for all three of those men. Folks, we are so absolutely blessed. Let's remember what God has given us collectively and what God has given us individually. And let's thank Him. It may not always go Ricky's way. It may not always go your way. But that's all right. As long as it's going God's way. Because in the end, I really don't matter that much. I hope you'll take that with the love and the kindness with which it was offered and beg you to remember, like Israel, we need to remember some things that God has done for us. The greatest that He's done for us is offer His Son as a gift. We sing the song, He paid it all. As far as the gift is concerned, He did. But we have a response. And that is, will I give my heart to Him? If you want to do that, won't you come while we stand up, while we sing?